Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on learning from current events right after this. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if your plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Well, listen to James Nielsen. Now, Nielsen is a professor of law at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about these lawyers. He said it's a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom and without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, our school courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Go to the archives page. Well, current events are going on around us every day. If you've been watching the news, probably the biggest news story going on is the Gulf oil spill. So we took a little license or liberty here, and we started doing some arithmetic. We're trying to figure out whether the Gulf oil spill is a black flag operation or whether it's just the Keystone Cops or the Three Stooges that are at work out here. But after 60 days, or nearly 60 days as I speak, we're finding that there's something unusual going on here. Let me describe for you what I see as being unusual. Here in the Midwest, in the wintertime, we usually have an ice storm or two. And when an ice storm comes through, it just tears the hell out of everything. I mean, it knocks the power lines down, the trees fall over on people's houses, and it just creates a heck of a mess. Well, what happens when all the power is knocked out is that the utility companies from all around come in and help us. For instance, here in Ozark County during the last ice storm, they had crews from Texas and Georgia here to help us put the power lines back together. Now, that's so that the more hands, you know, many hands make light work, and so the more people you get out here on the job, the faster you can get it done. Now, with oil spilling into the water, it would seem like to me that if you can't shut it off, then the thing you have to do is pick it up off the water, and that's called skimming. Well, now, if you're going to skim this oil off of the water, it would seem like to me that you should figure out how much oil is coming up and how many boats do we need to skim it off. And the answer is, if you've got a pen and paper out here, I'll give you some numbers. It's coming out of the wellhead down there at the rate of 50,000 barrels a day, 50,000 barrels a day, the latest number I just saw. Now, they're collecting 15,000 barrels a day and loading it in a ship. So 35,000 barrels are going into the water. So, you know, it just takes a, you know, just a minute here to figure out. Let's see, 15 from 50, that leaves 35,000 barrels a day. So it would seem like to me that BP needs to put out enough skimmer boats and enough tankers to collect 35,000 barrels a day. Now, just in case, you know, we're a little off here one way or the other, we probably ought to have a little room for error there. Maybe we better figure on 50,000 barrels a day. And that'll give us a little excess capacity. Does that make sense to you? Because that's kind of the way we used to run our business. You know, when I'm running a business, I put the numbers together on a piece of paper, and I say, okay, well, here's about what we're going to need. Well, the other day on the news, they told us that the Dutch offered 50 ships. They said, hey, we've got 50 skimmer boats over here in Holland. We'd be glad to send those over. And the government, I guess Obama administration or somebody, said, no, we don't need them. Well, now, it would seem like to me, with oil running loose all over the Gulf covering 36,000 square miles, that an extra 50 boats wouldn't be too many now, would it? I don't know how many boats it's going to take. I saw in the news the other day, BP said, we have 1,300 boats out here working. I said, well, you got 1,300 boats working, and the oil slick's getting bigger and bigger, so that says to me 1,300 ain't enough. I don't know how many it's going to take, but I do know that 1,300's not enough because the oil slick's getting bigger. And I got 1,300 out there, and the Dutch said, we'll send you 50 more, but it looks like 1,350 would be better than 1,300. That's why I said, I'm not quite sure whether we got the Keystone Cops or the Three Stooges working out here or not. But, you know, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure that out. But I want to point out to you people out there that all these people that are in control here graduated from college. They've all got college degrees, every one of them. There's nobody out there. You know, this guy, Tony Hayward, and the President of the United States, and all of his cabinet members, and the Secretary of Commerce, all these people, they've been to college. I mean, these people, you'd think, could be able to add and subtract and think a little bit clearer than that, wouldn't you? I'm not complaining. I'm not sitting here finding fault with President Obama or anybody else, but I did want to point out that there's a lot of oil leaking out into the water there, and it would seem like to me that 15 years ago they had a problem like this over in Dubai. An oil well blew out over there, so they brought in 6 super tankers, and they went to work skimming the oil off the top of the water, and they skimmed 80% of it off. Well, now, my common sense says if it worked 15 years ago there, wouldn't it work 15 years later here? Yet I heard the other day this Coast Guard guy said, well, see, that was a different operation over there, and it won't work here. And I thought, why not? He never did say why it wouldn't work. I'm not quite sure why, but it would seem like to me that if one day out of 6, you know, it would work, but it would seem like it would be worth doing one day out of 6. That would just take about 1/6 more oil off the water, wouldn't it? I mean, every little bit counts, doesn't it? Then I saw another thing in the news the other day concerning this that was a shocker. The mayor of Grand Isle, Louisiana, and I don't remember his name now, but he was testifying before Congress, and he said, we're spending more time trying to cut through red tape than we are cleaning up the oil. We can't get anything done because we can't get anybody's approval. Now, boys and girls, I thought that it was against the law to pollute the water. Now, if I went out in a fishing boat, and I dumped 5 gallons of gas over the side into the water, and Ranger Rick saw me, I was a little doubt in my mind, but he would come over, seize my boat, arrest me, and impound my boat, sell it at public auction, lock me up for the weekend over 5 gallons of gas and water. I would think 50,000 barrels a day would be something more serious than 5 gallons overboard on a fishing boat. Just seemed like that would be logical to me. Then, why can't we suspend the licensing fees and the red tape during the period of the crisis and simply tell the people of Grand Isle, get out there and clean up the well best you can. If this is what you think you need to do, do it. And if it violates the EPA rules, well, excuse me, but isn't 50,000 barrels of oil a day violating the rules already? I mean, what in the hell more can you do to harm the environment? What is it that the people in Louisiana are going to do that needs all of this regulation from Washington to prevent damage? I thought the damage had already been done and that they're doing the best they can to clean it up or to prevent further damage. I don't know. I didn't go to college and I don't have a degree and I'm just a vulgar, but I just thought I'd point that out, that it would seem like to me, just being a Joe Sixpack, my common sense says suspend the rules, throw OSHA and the EPA the hell out, and let the people down there figure out what they need to do on their own local beaches and their own local marshes, and let them go to work and get off their backs. You know, just common sense. All right, now, with that out of the way, we all got a chance to see the Twin Towers, and we've now learned that the Twin Towers was some kind of a black flag operation. I don't know whose black flag it was. I don't know if that was done by the CIA, the United States of America, or NATO, or some foreign power, but it's pretty obvious by now, after having seen all the DVDs and seen all the evidence now that's come in, now that that was a phonied up deal. Now, oftentimes governments do this in order to get our minds off of what it is that's really concerning us. And the thing that's really concerning us now is the economy. And the Greek meltdown and the European bailout and the stock markets tanking around the world. You know, May was the toughest month for stock markets worldwide than any month since 1940. Now, that sounded like a pretty important current event to me, but I never heard anybody report that other than what I've picked up here in the underground newsletters. Now, I'm putting some stuff together here for current events here to kind of bring you up to speed. But I thought we ought to talk about the oil spill down here first, because it's looking more and more like a black flag operation because of the way it's being handled. Now, when it first happened, you know, we all looked at it and said, gee, what a terrible accident. And maybe it was a terrible accident, but, you know, the thing to do when you have a terrible accident is to get out there and start picking up the pieces and get the traffic flowing again and pick up the bodies and take them off to the morgue and take the injured people to the hospital and let's see if we can get this thing under control again. It just doesn't seem like it's happening out there. And because of that, I look at that and I say to myself, you know, you don't have to be real smart. I'm not a whiz kid by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I'm not the sharpest marble in the drawer, but even I, dumb as I am, can figure out that 50 more boats from Holland would be a big help. Six super tankers from the Saudi Arabians or somebody over there with the captains and the expertise to skim oil off the water over there would be a big help to us over here. And my common sense tells me that putting all these chemicals in the water to dissipate the oil, it wasn't really the smartest move in the world, because how does that change anything? I mean, dissolving the oil in the water doesn't pick it up and remove it from the water. It simply suspends it in the water like detergent suspends grease in your dishwater. Now, it would seem like to me, just being a layman, now I'm not an expert, you know, on biology or fish or anything like that, but oil floats on top of the water. Now, if the oil is floating on top of the water, it would seem like it would be easier to skim it off the top of the water than it would be to collect it from the dissolved state in the dishwater. Doesn't it? So they have dissolved this oil in the water, and so now the fish have to swim through this dissolved oil and they have to breathe it. Do you think dissolved oil in the water is healthy for fish? If you want to test it, why don't you do this? Why don't you take a pan of grease and pour it into your dishwater, put in some detergent, stir it around a little bit, then go over to your fish tank, pull out some fish and dump them in the dishwater and see how they fare. Now, you're probably sitting there saying to yourself, well, you've got to be out of your mind. Well, excuse me, boys and girls, if you wouldn't do that with your fish in your fish tank, why in the hell would you do that with your fish in the Gulf of Mexico? And again, I'm not a fish biologist, no, but just my common sense would tell me that it would be better if that water had the oil floating on top. Let's try it this way. Let's suppose you've got a fish tank over here and you pour your bacon grease on top of the fish tank. I think it's all going to float on top. That probably isn't going to be good for your fish, but dissolving it in the water with detergent, I think, is going to be worse, don't you? Okay, now there's one more thing that I noticed here that kind of bothered me a little bit. If you've got a spot out here in the ocean where the oil is coming up, and it's 42 miles offshore, wouldn't it make more sense to try to pick that up just as close to the source, just as close to the oil well as possible, and to keep that oil from spreading? Well, the last time I saw a number, it spread over 36,000 square miles. I would think that we should keep that oil boomed in, hemmed in, skimmed off, work just as close to that well as possible, like, you know, within 5 or 10 square miles of that well. And don't let it get outside that 10 square miles or 5 square miles. I don't see anybody very concerned about that, and I've never heard of anybody mentioning, hey, we need to pick this oil up just as rapidly as possible right here at the site. Now, there was one more thing that came on the news last night. I was watching the news, and sometimes I have to pinch myself to make sure that I'm awake, because the guy said that BP is picking up 15,000 barrels a day out of the 50,000 that's escaping from the wellhead. And they're loading it in a ship, and that the ship is just about full, and they don't have another ship on the way and won't for another week. And I thought to myself, excuse me, isn't this scheduling 101? I mean, surely there must be somebody involved in this oil company here. That if they were picking up 15,000 barrels a day, and they got a ship over here that holds 100,000 barrels, it looks like in about 7 days they're going to fill the boat up. And so it means about every 7 days they need another boat out there. And then just to make sure, don't you think you ought to have one sitting out there empty, just on station, just, you know, in case the well was picking up a little bit, and maybe we picked up 20 or 25,000 barrels a day. Shouldn't we have a little excess capacity out there? Shouldn't Exxon or Shell Oil or somebody send one over there just kind of on standby? I notice here when we have an accident on the highway patrol will send out somebody, you know, for the accident, but then typically they'll send out a couple of more. You know, not that we really needed six highway patrolmen out here to handle the accident, but, you know, just in case. You know, what if there was a second accident right here because of the first accident? What if a second one occurred? Maybe we need an extra guy out here to direct traffic or something. And I notice they usually have a few extras. But here on this oil slick over here, this is the biggest thing to hit the United States, I think, in the history of the country. Has there ever been anything like this before? I can't think of anything. So it would seem like to me that Exxon and Standard Oil and Shell and some of these other guys ought to be out there, you know, standing by. Well, what can we do to help you? You know, at least light your cigarettes and pour your coffee. And I don't see any of that. And then when I got down to the beaches over here, I see that we got the local people out here picking up tar bowls off the beaches. But don't you think that at a time like this, when we have something like, I think it was 20 million, is it 20 million, or is it 20% of the teenagers? Maybe it's 20% of the teenagers in the country that are unemployed. Don't you think this would be a pretty good job for kids to get out there on the beach and clean those up? I don't know, guys. You got 6 million people unemployed. We're all sitting there watching TV, and we don't seem to be able to get the Army or the National Guard. The government can't seem to mobilize people, put them out there on the beaches to pick up the tar balls and one thing and another. And then there was a kicker that came the other day. They were showing this on that was on NBC News, and they had these guys there in white suits and in a boat, and they were coming up to some reeds down here in southern Louisiana. And the guy's taking paper towels, and he rips off a paper towel, and he reaches down, and he wipes this dead reed with oil on it. I looked at that and I said, surely you must be jesting. What is this? You know, are we watching the Three Stooges here? You're dumping 50,000 barrels a day into the water and you're cleaning it up with paper towels? Huh? I mean, really, you know, don't you think it's time to get real? What in the hell is this? It would look like to me that there's enough work to do out there without playing games. You know, getting out there and cleaning reeds off with paper towels, you know, that's just stupid. And let's just wake up and smell the coffee here. That's something you might expect to see in an insane asylum, but surely you know when you've got thousands and thousands of barrels of oil, you know, gushing out and washing up on your beaches over here, that we've got to come up with a little better plan than paper towels. So I just thought for those reasons that I'd start off today's program and say, I'm not quite sure that I'm fully persuaded that this thing wasn't a setup from day one. Although it's hard to believe that human beings anywhere, even for money, would do such a thing. I just cannot, it was like watching airplanes fly into tall buildings, you know, I just could not believe that somebody would do such a thing. It never entered my mind, and it never entered my mind for a second that somebody would deliberately spill an oil or screw up an oil well like that so that it would spill out into the ocean and cause that kind of damage. And I don't think we've seen the end of this, and it could well be that this is going to be a piece of damage on biblical proportions. Let's see if that's right. Now, if you've got your pen and paper out here, gather around because we've collected a lot of neat statistics and numbers. If you're a baseball fan, you'll love this because we've got the numbers right here. At the wellhead, this is pretty spectacular. You've seen the pictures coming, you know, down at the bottom of the ocean here. There's a pipe, and you see this black oil gushing out of it. And the question arose, well, how many pounds per square inch, or how many barrels a day or gallons a day is coming out of that pipe, and how big is that pipe? All right, write this down. The pipe is 19 and a half inches in diameter. That's the inside diameter of it, 19 and a half inches. I do not know what the gauge of the pipe is, quarter inch, half inch pipe, I don't know just what that is. But it's sitting on top of this thing called a blowout protector. And this blowout protector, for some reason, has misfired. It didn't work. And it's got some kind of a valve in it that shuts this well off, and it's either the pressure was so high that it blew it out, or when the well blew out, it damaged it in such a way that the valve won't shut it off. In any event, it's not working. So the amount of oil that's coming out is coming out at the rate of 6,200 pounds per square inch at the wellhead into the water, 6,200 pounds. I thought that was absolutely amazing. I'd never heard of such a thing before. Now, in Prudhoe Bay, when they drilled those wells up there, that field is under pressure. And at the time, 1968, when they drilled those holes up there, they had 1,600 pounds of pressure. Now, that's pretty impressive because that means that oil is coming out of the ground under pressure. You don't have to pump it. It just comes out naturally all by itself. That's the way they get oil over in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, Iraq. That oil over there is under pressure. Now, here in Texas, here in the United States, we drill an oil well, we got to pump it out. That's what those pump jacks are doing out there. We got to pump it. It doesn't come out under pressure. Those are called gushers. Well, this well here is a gusher, no doubt about that. Coming out at 6,200 pounds per square inch at the wellhead out of a 19.5-inch pipe. And it's down at the bottom of 5,280 feet of water. So there's a water column on top of that thing, a water collar on top of it. And it's 3,960 column pounds per square inch pressure over the wellhead. Now, if you're a plumber, you know that the water in a pipe standing straight up is about 3 pounds per foot. So if you're wondering, you know, what kind of water pressure you're going to get, if you just go up in the air 10 feet, multiply that times 0.75, I'll tell you about how many pounds per square inch you're going to have of pressure coming into the house. So if you want 45 pounds of pressure, well, then you got to move that thing up in the air about 60 feet. See how simple that is? No big mystery about that. All right, now, think about this, because if this well was on land and you hit this gusher over here, that thing would be putting it out at the rate of 10,160 pounds per square inch at atmospheric pressure, and atmospheric pressure is 14.7 psi. So atmospheric pressure is 14.7 psi, and that well is putting pressure out at the rate of 10,160 psi at atmospheric pressure. Under sea pressure, it's putting it out at 6,200 pounds. And I think that's why they can't get a handle on it. Now, you know, if we're talking about pounds per square inch, you're probably sitting there going, well, I don't know that I can really understand or grasp that. So let me give you a couple of numbers here, and that'll maybe help you understand it. The well itself, through the rock, is 18,000 feet deep. Now, that's over 3 miles. It's a mile down to the ocean bed. We're talking about 4 miles deep, 4 miles down to this oil pool. And there's a big pool of oil down here, which is under pressure. Now, liquids don't compress, and because a liquid doesn't compress, it just builds up pounds per square inch. And so there's a lot of tons of rock and earth and water on top of this oil pool, which creates all this pressure. So they drilled a hole down through it to relieve the pressure, and they got down there to the oil pool, and it came out at the rate of about 10,160 psi at atmospheric pressure, which is where they were because they had a pipe connected all the way down to the oil pool. Now, they had drilling mud in this pipe, which more than counteracted the 10,160 psi in the pipe because they had 11,000 pounds of mud on top of it holding it down. Now, they decided that they wanted to take a couple of shortcuts and save a little time, so they said, let's pull the drilling mud out and replace that with seawater. Now, note that the seawater doesn't weigh as much as the drilling mud, and so there was a controversy on board the drilling rig, and the drilling company said, no, no, you can't do that, and the officials from BP said, yes, yes, we can, and we're paying the bills, and that's the way we want to run the show. And there was a fellow that was, he's dead now, he's one of the 11 guys that got killed. He was a tool pusher on the machine. And he came back the week before this thing went off, and he told his wife that he wanted to make out his will, and that if he didn't come back, that the company would take care of her and the kids, and he made out his will. Now, there was something going on in the week before, maybe even the month before, that this tool pusher, an experienced well driller, knew what was happening out there, and he said, hey, this isn't good. Now, you know, on any kind of a job, I don't care whether it's a construction job or wherever you're at, the men that are working on the job, they may not have access to the files, and they may not know what's going on in the inner sanctum, but they're the guys that are putting on the roofs, and they're the guys that are putting in the headers, and they know what's going on the job. And when there's skullduggery going on, they know it, and they talk about it. We call it scuttlebutt going around the job. And so that was what was going on here, and some of these guys knew that there was bad decisions being made, kind of like on the Titanic. Captain Smith had 5 notes in his pocket that said, here's the icebergs up for me. They knew where the icebergs were located. They knew the general size and scope of the ice pack. Now, you'd have thought that the captain with 39 years of experience would have steered the boat south and slowed her down, but, you know, he didn't do that. He speeded up, and he kept her right on course. And, of course, you know, history now has told the tale. Now, 50 years from now, we'll be talking about this Deepwater Horizon drilling rig over here that sank and caused this great oil spill, and it'll make history book just like the Titanic did, and we'll be looking at it and saying to ourselves, huh, how could these people have been so stupid? Well, it appears from the reports that we get so far is that they were trying to save $10 million. They were trying to cut corners, save $10 million. And I thought that was really, really dumb, you know, just from the point of view of a layperson here watching this, because I did the numbers on this, and this well over here is worth a lot of money. I don't know if you've ever thought about how much money comes out of one of these oil wells. Well, here in Kansas, I had a student come in here, and he has some old oil wells that have played out their usefulness, you know, years ago. But they produce about 10 barrels of oil a day. I think he said on average he gets about 10 barrels a day out of these oil wells. Now, oil is selling for $70 a barrel. So if you've got an old oil well over here in Kansas out in the cornfield someplace producing 10 barrels a day, that's 10 times 7, that's $700 a day. Now, the 700 times 365, you know, for us little guys down here, is $255,500 a year. You know, with the cost of loading it up and transporting it down to the refinery and so on, you know, a family, you know, could make a pretty good living off of one oil well producing 10 barrels a day in a cornfield in Kansas, couldn't they? All right. Now, you have to pump that oil out of there, and it takes 17% of the oil that you pump out is the cost of pumping it out. In other words, you got to pay electricity, and there's breakdowns on the oil well. You got things that have to be bought and paid for, cost of goods sold. And the numbers work out to 17%. So, you know, if you had $250,000, just round numbers, and then you just multiply that times 0.17, it would cost you about $42,500 a year to pump that oil out of there. So you'd net about $200,000 a year at $70 a barrel. Not bad, right? All right. Now, these oil wells that are out here in the Gulf of Mexico, these deep oil wells, they don't pump any oil out of those wells, and they can't because they're so deep. They rely on the pressure that's under the ocean there, the pressure that's in the gas or in the oil pool. Now, up at Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, the oil pressure when they drilled those wells up there was 1,600 pounds. They call that field pressure. And the last time I saw a number, I think it was National Geographic, said that the field pressure up there now after, 30 years or 40 years of pumping is at 355 pounds. Now, the day is going to come when all of the field pressure is going to dissipate and it'll be at zero. And from that point on, they're going to have to pump that oil out. They'll have to put pumping jacks up there, just like you see in Texas and Wyoming and Oklahoma, and they're going to have to pump the oil out. Now, you can't do that out there in the ocean, at least not yet. And they don't do that over in Saudi Arabia, where they also have 1,600 pounds of field pressure. Only the field pressure is still 1,600 pounds over there. They haven't lost their field pressure. Now, it makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it, boys and girls, to drill a well where you're going to get field pressure and you don't have to spend 17% to pump it out of the ground. It saves you 17%. You make more money. And then on top of that, it's easier and faster, and just all you have to do is just turn the valve off, you know, or turn the valve on, or slow the valve down. You know, if you got too much oil coming out, you just close her down a little bit. You need more oil, just open her up. That's just a hell of a neat deal, and I don't blame the oil companies for doing that. That's just good thinking on their part. And these oil wells out there, they've drilled about 400. So if you're wondering how many of these deep, high-pressure oil wells there are in the Gulf, 400 is the number. Stand by. I'm going to give you a mid-course reminder here, and then we'll come back and we'll give you some more numbers on this well spill out here. I think it's a pretty fascinating story. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements are recommendations that we give. Don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about current events. The big current event right at the moment is called the oil spill, the Gulf oil spill. And just giving you some of the numbers and talking a little bit about what is going on here with the operation out here. Let me give you some numbers as it relates to pressures, because this pressure of 6,200 pounds per square inch is absolutely astronomical. That is phenomenal. Let me give you a reason why. In 1860, the steam locomotives were running at about 145 pounds per square inch pressure. 145 pounds. By 1880, steam locomotives were operating at about 350 pounds of pressure. Boy, that was a big upgrade because it gave them immense power. The difference between 150 and 350 is like night and day. It's geometric in its progression. Well, by 1900, they were up to 500 to 600 pounds of pressure. Now, once in a while, these steam locomotives will blow up. And in 1918, an Alco steam locomotive using superheated steam. Now, superheated steam is 1,500 pounds per square inch. Think of this now. 1860, we got 150 pounds, round numbers. Then we go up to 350, then 600. By 1918, we've just about peaked out. This is about as hot as you can run these steam locomotives. It's about 1,600 pounds per square inch, about the same amount of pressure as you have in an oil or gas field in Saudi Arabia or Prudhoe Bay. I mean, that is powerful, 1,600 pounds per square inch. Well, a steam locomotive blew up in Tennessee in 1918, and they never found the fireman or the engineer. And the reason that they didn't find them is because they were cooked and vaporized. That's how hot and that's how powerful that blast was. Now, when you want to pressure cook a chicken, when you want to cook a chicken, you stick him in a pot of boiling water and you cook him for an hour, and he gets pretty tender and you can chew him up and eat him. If you want to speed up the process, you put him in a pressure cooker for 15 minutes, and you can cook that sucker in 15 minutes instead of an hour. If you put him in a pressure cooker, and that's only 6 pounds per square inch, 6 psi, cooks a chicken in 15 minutes. Now, when you run a steam locomotive up to 1,500 pounds, that isn't where this engine blew up. See, it's going to have some reserve. In order for that thing to blow up, it had to be at 2,500 or 3,000 pounds per square inch when it finally went off. You see, its operating pressure is 1,500. And so it's going to have some reserve, 500 or 1,000, extra. Kind of like running a submarine, it's rated at 350 feet, but, you might run it down to 500, 600 feet and get away with it once or twice. But there's a limit, and when that limit is reached and that engine blew up, all that was left was the wheels on the tracks, and everything else was gone. In fact, 3 or 4 cars back behind the locomotive were all gone. They just disintegrated, went up in the air, and come down in little pieces. Now, of course, the two men that were inside here, they were instantly vaporized. That steam, when it hit them, it cooked their flesh. It turned them to steam, and they just evaporated right into the atmosphere. their clothes, their shoes, everything about them. I know it's kind of grisly, but I mean that's how powerful 2,000 pounds per square inch is. Now that's what a nuclear power plant operates at. Nuclear power plants operate at 2,200 pounds per square inch. Now think of this. That oil well in the Gulf of Mexico is spewing out at 6,200 pounds. That's three times what a nuclear power plant operates at. I thought that was pretty spectacular. That's three times what a steam locomotive would operate at. And that's what they call superheated steam. Now, the column of water is 5,280 feet high, right over the top of that 19-inch oil well opening that's coming out. That means that there's 4,000 pounds per square inch pushing down on that oil coming out. And it's still coming out at 6,200 pounds per square inch at the wellhead. You talk about powerful now. So it led me to believe that, well, maybe what happened here was that this thing was just too powerful and they weren't able to rein it in. And I got to look and we went online to take a look at pressures and we found out that they expect pressures as high as 15,000 pounds per square inch, which would be more than double what it's operating at right now. But 10,160 PSI at atmospheric pressure was getting up there toward the design capability of that blowout protector. Remember, the blowout protector is in a straight line from the oil pool straight up to the top of the drilling rig, which is on top of the ocean. So we're operating at 14.7 pounds per square inch. So when that thing blew up, they were operating at 14.7. They had to keep 10,160 PSI to hold that oil down there and hold it in place. But had the blowout protector worked correctly, it would have held it, at least in theory, because they said it was designed for 15,000. But, you know, it just could well be that they thought it would hold 15,000, but when 10,000 pounds hit it, it just broke it, and it didn't work. And the rest is history. I don't know. We'll find out more as we go along. But these pressures, I thought, were just phenomenal. In fact, these pressures are what we talk about in terms of hydraulics. This isn't operating pressures. These are hydraulic pressures. Now, the highest hydraulic pressures that we've seen, and I suppose there's some exceptions to this, but about 80 to 100,000 pounds per square inch is about what you see in a machine shop. You know, when you got a hydraulic press and you're pressing bearings on and off of shafts, you know, it's pretty common to run 10, 15, 20. I even ran one time up to 40,000 PSI. It was rated at 80, but there wasn't anybody there that I ever talked to that ever ran it up to 80 or ever wanted to, because if the piece of metal that you're working with breaks, it can come out of there like a gun and kill you. Now, there was a story that came out, just to give you an illustration about how powerful these pressures are and how dangerous they are. There was a bath escape. They called it a bath escape back in 1929, 30, 31 to 34, and there was a guy by the name of Beebe that came up with another guy, and they came up with this round cylinder. It was a ball, and they dropped it into the ocean, and they ran it down for some pressure tests and some depth tests, and they ran it down ultimately in 1934. They reached the world record at 3,400 feet. This is back in the 1930s. Imagine this, 3,400 feet. Now, this oil well is at 5,280 feet. Well, on this bathysphere, they dropped it in the ocean. They ran it down to, I don't know, I think it was 3,000 feet or something like that, and a window in it leaked, and it filled up. And then when it filled up with water, it filled up with water at nearly 3,000 pounds per square inch pressure. Then they pulled the bathysphere back up and set it down on the deck. And then they needed to get into it, so they took a wrench and they started unscrewing the nuts and bolts on the faceplate. And the first bolt that they took out, a stream of water came out through the hole at 3,000 pounds per square inch. If somebody had been standing in front of it, it would have gone through them like a bullet. That's how powerful that jet stream of water was. Now, if you remember when you were in school, they talked about the oil, or not the oil, but the gold miners in California. They used to use hydraulic water, to wash the gravel out of the mountains so that they could get the gold out of it. And they used big streams of water. And that water, you know, would come out of a hose, probably 6 inches in diameter, neck it down to about 1 inch to increase the pressure, and it would shoot out about 150 feet. And the pressure was at 175 pounds per square inch as it hit the bank. And when you go out there and you take a look at these old sites, you know, they'll have placards out there and they'll have the old mining equipment and the old nozzles and pumps that they were pumping it with. Wow, 175 pounds. If you were standing in front of that 175 pounds, it'd knock you right off your feet. You know when hell you could stand up to 1 inch of pressure at 175 pounds. Just like, you know, you're out there cleaning your driveway off and you get the nozzle and you got your water pressure. Well, that water pressure at your house is 45 pounds per square inch. And you neck it down in a half-inch hose, and then you neck it down to about a quarter of an inch coming out of the nozzle, and then you clean the little rocks and pebbles off, and you push them around. Well, you know, that's the same principle. Now, when we talk about 6,200 PSI coming out at the wellhead, if you were down there and stuck your hand into that maelstrom of oil, it would just disintegrate your hand. It would just blow it right off. That's pressure. I mean, you're talking about big-time pressure, which tells us a little something about why it is they're unable to get a cap on it. I would suspect that they've never had a problem like this before, because they're trying to put a cap on top of this thing by pressuring it on top of the smooth side of the pipe that comes out above those two flanges. Now, if you'll think about those two flanges, I used to work in a shipyard, and I can tell you from personal experience that if an engineer in the shipyard ran up against this problem, it would take 7 days to make a cap to shut that off. I can just tell you from personal experience. From the time that we would run into a problem out on the floor, an engineer would come out, and they'd photograph it from every angle. They'd go back to the office, and they'd pull out the plans. They'd take all the measurements. They'd come out with a measured drawing, put it back on the floor, and say, build one of these. We would take the measured drawing, we would build one of those, and it would solve the problem every time. So I just looked at that, and I said, well, if I wanted to cap that thing off, what I would do is to build another shut-off valve, like that blowout protector, and I'd build it with a flange that hooks on to those two flanges so that it bolts on underneath it and use the two flanges to keep it from blowing off or from pulling off of the standpipe that's coming off the top of the two flanges that you see bolted together in the photographs. It would take us about 3 weeks to build something like that in all probability from scratch. I don't know how thick a boilerplate you'd have to use, probably 2 inch or something like that, maybe 4, I don't know. You might have to use some pretty heavy-duty stuff because you're trying to contain 6,200 pounds of pressure. But there isn't any doubt in my mind that that could be built in less than a month and put on there with remote control. They've put 3 on there already that didn't work. So I know that somebody can build a shutoff valve, and I know that you can put it on there by bolting it on under those flanges. Now, it might be that the tensile strength of the flanges hooked onto the pipe, 6,200 pounds, might just pull them right apart. I don't know, because I don't know how heavy that steel is where those flanges are hooked on there. It could well be that somebody's already thought of that and said, well, that isn't going to work. Well, if that isn't going to work, I got news for you, boys and girls. You ain't got anything that's going to work, not on that thing. So they've done just about everything they're going to do. They're taking 15,000 pounds or 15,000 barrels out of it, and they're losing 35,000, which is probably about the best they can do working with those kind of pressures. I don't think they've got a problem working at depth, because if they're able to put those machines on there, they've put 3 caps on there already. They haven't had any problem getting them on. Their problem is they can't keep them on, and I can see why they can't keep them on. So now they're going to drill 2 wells in, one from each side. Now that's really technology at work. I'm telling you, if you think about that problem that they've got, and I don't have any doubt in my mind but what that's going to work. I don't know if it'll solve the problem, because I don't know if this is a black flag operation or what, not yet, but they're going to drill in from the side, and they're going to come in down 1,000, 2,000 feet down, and they're boring in from the side now. They're out there a half a mile. They're going to drill 2 of them, and as soon as they hit that column, they hit that well, they're going to take half of the pressure off, because now you've got a Y, and as the oil is coming up out of the ground, it's going to hit that Y. Half of it's going to go up one side. Half of it's going to continue up where it's at, and it'll cut that pressure up there from 6,200 pounds to 3,100. If they can get the second well in there, they can cut that down by a third. They can take 2,000 pounds off of one side, 2,000 pounds off the other side, and 2,000 pounds up the middle, and that'll get her down to about the working pressure of a steam boiler in a nuclear power plant. Boy, you talk about a problem now. Those boys have a problem. They're going to be working with 2,000 pounds per square inch. At that point in time, maybe they can put a cap on there. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not an engineer, and that's beyond my expertise or my ability, but I just thought it was interesting for all of us to see what the problem is. It could well be, boys and girls, and this was brought out by the host of the McLaughlin group on Friday night. He said, has it occurred to anybody that they might not be able to shut that thing off? And if you couldn't shut that off, what kind of an oil spill is that going to mean over what period of time? Has anybody ever done the numbers on that? Well, as a matter of fact, they have. This thing, this well, is 23,280 feet deep. So if you're looking at the numbers here, at 6,200 PSI, 3,960 column pressure pounds per square inch over the top of that pipe coming out, 10,160 PSI at atmospheric pressure, 18,000-foot well with 5,280 feet of water in the column, that sucker is sitting down there. That oil pool is sitting down there at 23,280 feet deep, and it's delivering 15,000 barrels per day to the surface going into a ship, and 35,000 barrels a day going into the water. That sucker is delivering 50,000 barrels a day at the wellhead. Now remember, if you've got a well, like in Saudi Arabia, that's producing 10, 15,000 barrels a day, you've got one of the most profitable things God ever put on earth. This thing is at least three times better than anything I've heard of over in Saudi Arabia. I don't know that any well over there is producing 50,000 barrels a day. So when they hit this well, I mean, they hit the mother load. They hit the mother load. It's too bad that they wanted to cut corners and save $10 million because the $10 million that they tried to save is going to cost billions. The total value of that well, if you were wondering what it was worth in numbers, works like this. It's delivering 50,000 barrels per day at the wellhead. That's 2,100,000 gallons a day times 60 days. So far, it has produced 126 million gallons. Now, 126 million gallons divided by 6,000 gallons in a truckload is 21,000 tanker trucks. Now, you know when you go into the Circle K store and you want to buy a pack of cigarettes or a six-pack of beer, pay for your gas, and there's a big truck out there, and he's emptying that into the underground tanks. All right. That truck hauls 6,000 gallons. 6,000 gallons. Well, sir, it takes 21,000 of those. That's what's been dumped in there so far in 60 days. Now, at $70 a barrel, that's $3.5 million a day. That well is producing $3.5 million a day worth of oil. That's $1.277 billion a year. Let me run over those numbers again. I mean, you talk about hitting the mother load here. These oil wells out there, these deep oil wells, of which they've got 400 of them out there that are working, 400 working wells, and you got one well here now that's working, but it's a little out of control. And that thing is producing 1.277. That's $1.25 billion a year, and you don't have to pump any of it. It's all coming out under pressure. How long do they expect that well to pump oil like that? And the answer is 30 years. Just like the North Slope of Alaska, they've been pumping on that since 1968. That's 32 years. They still got 355 pounds of pressure up there. May last for another 10 or 15 years. We don't know. Now, that's how profitable those wells are. That's what that well is producing. So to try to save $10 million and run the risk of that thing blowing out like it did was poor economics, unless it was done on purpose. Huh? Because $10 million was chump change compared to just the profitability on the well itself. All right, kids, I'm out of time. I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.